KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. That's workinames.com.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today, and I'm joined by Greta Anderson. Greta used to be a regular host on Local Talk, but now she's moved on to bigger and better things, so we're glad to have her here for a guest appearance today. Thanks for being here, Greta.
Well, my pleasure, Gail, although I don't know if there's anything bigger and better than KHOI Community Radio.
Good point. And later in the show, Greta will bring us two interviews that she did about new developments in mental health care in the area. And in the last part of the show, we'll be hearing about a poverty simulation, and we'll learn what it is and why you might want to participate. So please stay tuned with us for all of that. I hope you had a good St. Patrick's Day, and maybe you enjoyed some corned beef and cabbage or Irish soda bread. And in honor of St. Patrick's Day, we'll be hearing some Irish music a little later in the show. But we had a surprise on the morning of St. Patrick's Day when we woke up to an unexpected snowfall. The weather for the remainder of the week in Central Iowa does not appear to hold any more surprises, although the temperature will vary quite a bit. Today will be in the low 50s, but then it will dip into the 30s and 40s on Tuesday and Wednesday, rising again into the 50s later in the week. It doesn't look like there will be any precipitation, just a mix of sun and clouds, and it looks like it will get quite windy by Friday and Saturday, with winds up to 24 miles per hour on those days. Here's a summary of local Iowa news as well as Iowa in the national news during the past week, brought to you by the Iowa Informer. Last week, Senator Majority Leader Bill Dix was caught having an affair with a State House lobbyist and subsequently stepped down from his position. Now, a controversial top aide of former Senator Dix has announced that he is also stepping down. The aide, Ed Failer, Jr., started working for the Senate GOP after a tenure as president of Iowans for Tax Relief. Failer, like Dix, had come under fire for his handling of sexual harassment in the Senate GOP caucus. Former communications director Kirsten Anderson had sued the GOP caucus for sexual harassment and had named Failer in her lawsuit last fall. Anderson's lawsuit resulted in a $1.75 million settlement, which stated that Failer disparaged her writing abilities and, quote, routinely made negative comments about her clothing style. Fowler said in a statement, "It is in the best interest of the Senate Republican caucus for me to leave my position at this time. I truly enjoyed the more than 5 years I spent in the Iowa Senate. I am proud of the broad and substantive conservative agenda this chamber has passed on behalf of Iowans. It is the right time for me to pursue opportunities in the private sector." End of quote. On Wednesday, Senate Republicans voted to fill Bill Dix's seat as majority leader with Jack Whitver of Ankeny. Whitver is the Iowa Senate president. Friday marked the state legislature's second funnel deadline, meaning that bills passed in one chamber that hadn't yet passed out of committee in the other chamber were considered not viable or dead. Among the high-profile bills that have survived is a fetal heartbeat abortion proposal that would be the strictest anti-abortion law in the country and would, in practice, outlaw nearly all abortions in the state. Many believe that the bill will be challenged in court as unconstitutional if it is passed. Some other bills that have made it through the second funnel and are still considered viable include $2 billion tax cut proposals, a proposal to amend the state's constitution to call for a convention of states to limit the federal government's power, a bill aimed at Dakota Access Pipeline protesters that would implement harsh felony charges for alleged critical infrastructure sabotage, and an anti-sanctuary city bill that would force law enforcement to comply with federal immigration officials. Many law enforcement units in Iowa have voiced opposition to this bill. Some bills that did not survive the funnel on Friday include a ban on highway protests that targeted anti-Trump protesters in Iowa City who temporarily blocked Interstate 80 after the 2016 election, a proposal to require an Iowa Supreme Court supermajority ruling in order to declare a law unconstitutional, which itself would likely violate the state's constitution, a so-called religious freedom bill that would allow businesses and schools to refuse services to members of the LGBT community. This bill was opposed by the Ames Chamber of Commerce and other Iowa business organizations. Also not meeting the funnel deadline, a work requirement to receive Medicaid services, a bill allowing for the carrying of guns on school grounds, and a sweeping proposal to eliminate a full third of the state government's regulatory rules. For the second straight year, Emily's Law also failed to pass. This bill, named for an Iowa State University student who in 2015 was struck and killed by a hit-and-run Cyride driver, would have increased penalties for failing to report a hit-and-run if the driver had a reason to believe the accident may have resulted in an injury or death. Lawmakers questioned whether the law would be unconstitutional. However, similar hit-and-run laws have all held up to court challenges in several other states and in federal courts. And that is the legislative summary for this week. Now, some other Iowa news. According to the Office of Governor Kim Reynolds, Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, who also serves as one of his White House advisors, plans to visit Iowa today. She is scheduled to meet with students in Waukee, participate in a roundtable discussion on education in Iowa, and tour the Suburban School District's Innovation and Learning Center. This program is a partnering hub for students, teachers, and the local business community. Reynolds plans to join Ivanka Trump on her tour of Iowa. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller expressed his concerns about a recent report on home ownership by the Center for Investigative Reporting. The report showed that Latinos who are pursuing home loans in the Iowa City area are almost four times likelier to be denied loans than non-Latino whites. This would be the worst disparity in any city in the nation. Miller announced last week that his office will take a closer look at the report's findings and consider options. However, he declined to specify what those options might include. According to the Associated Press, the Iowa Civil Rights Commission has announced it won't investigate the findings because it has inadequate funding to do so. And those are some of this past week's stories of Iowa in the News provided by the Iowa Informer. More stories can be found at iowainformer.com. Well, for the last several years, Iowa has had the dubious distinction of being ranked 50th among the states for its provision of mental health care. For most of today's show, we're going to be discussing how that might be turning around. And for those interviews, we have local talk reporter Greta Anderson.
Yes, well, I have got a couple of interviews. Last week, I spoke with Jody Eaton on the phone. She is the CEO of CICS, or Central Iowa Community Services, which is known as the Mental Health Region under the Department of Human Services, or DHS. This is a 10-county administrative unit charged by the Iowa legislature for funding of core mental health services for those who are not Medicaid eligible, so the uninsured or underinsured who do not have mental health coverage. Until 4 years ago, this was the job of each county in Iowa. So there was a difficult challenge as they reshuffled and regionalized this system of delivery. Just recently, our region, CICS, has announced a whole spate of new programs that show it's really expanding mental health coverage. We're going to hear Jody Eaton of CICS talk about them, but here's just a quick rundown of the new programs. There's crisis intervention training for law enforcement focusing on mental health issues, expanded drop-in centers where trained peers, folks who have experienced mental health crises and are now on the other side, provide support. There's mental health first aid training, a jail diversion program so that those with mental health issues don't just get jailed, they can have other options. There's telepsychiatry at emergency rooms to deal with the shortage of psychiatrists, a mental health crisis hotline, which we will be giving the number of several times this show. And now we have a mobile mental health crisis response service that will dispatch a team to anyone in this 10-county region who calls the hotline and seems to be in need of in-person services. My conversation with Jody touched on many of these new services and a new bill that passed the House 98-0, addressing mental health needs in Iowa. Jody and other regional heads like her played a key role in advising legislators on what was needed. So here's Jody Eaton, starting out by talking about the beginnings of the mental health region about 4 years ago.
You know, first of all, we did have to set kind of the groundwork or the base, which was to make sure that we had all of the community-based services that were necessary. So those would be the outpatient clinics, therapy and medication management, and also those community-based services for supported community living and supported employment and those types of things. So setting that groundwork was very important because as we expand now into crisis services and alternatives to incarceration, you have to have those services in place in order to have a place to divert individuals to. So now we're to that point, and we've been working on crisis services. We fund crisis appointments at least one provider in every county, so that people can be seen timely. We have a telepsych program that we have put into each of the hospitals that we are funding in order for people to have a psychiatric evaluation in the emergency rooms. We have a 24-hour crisis line so that, you know, individuals may be able to call and get counseling and get referral services at any time. It isn't always the best idea for people to wait until the provider opens or an office opens in order to get the help they need. So this crisis line is available, and there are also chat and text options with that. We also have outpatient services in the jails as well as telepsych in the jails, and then also fund intensive case management for individuals for discharge planning and just to make sure that, you know, if they don't need to be incarcerated, they have other options available.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this brings up, before we get into the details of these different programs, it brings up a basic point that so much of the time mental health care is bumped up to a level that is much more expensive for the taxpayer when you have someone going to jail or someone going to the emergency room rather than being seen by a mental health professional. You are really increasing the cost simply because these opportunities, these venues have not existed for so long.
That's correct. Just looking at our telepsych reports from the emergency rooms, about, I think, between 45% and 48% of individuals are being diverted. So they're really either able to go to a crisis stabilization place for, you know, up to 5 days or possibly get an appointment with outpatient right away. So we already know that we are saving money for Medicaid because we are having fewer inpatient stays with that program in place.
Now, if a person's not on Medicaid, and that those are the folks that you cover, mm-hmm. I know somebody who went to the emergency room and was so in need of psychological care that he pretended to be suicidal. He pretended to have a plan so that they would, you know, admit him. Otherwise, he would have been turned away and gotten no referrals, no care. Is that a common scenario?
You know, we do hear that frustration that if they don't fit a certain level, they're not able to get that care. That's why it is very important that we continue on with the crisis stabilization programs. That would be an alternative for the individual to go to.
Right.
And those are available, but the education of getting that word out there to people that those are available has been slow. So we really appreciate any help we can in getting the information out there about all the alternatives that we have available for these services. The mobile response that we have launching at the end of this month is going to be huge. It is going to be probably a game changer, because if the mobile response team is called out there, they know these resources. They'll be able to do an assessment and determine, does this person need hospitalization? Do they need crisis stabilization? What level of care do they need? And then help them get into that.
And that is based simply upon a phone call to the crisis hotline.
Correct. Before they actually go live and start taking call, we will be sending out a press release on that. But even at this time, the 24-hour crisis line is available. And that is still, you know, a very helpful service for individuals who, you know, aren't really sure where they should be going.
Okay, I'm going to give our listeners a minute to get a piece of paper and a pencil so they can write that number down. In the meantime, you're expanding services, you know, drastically, it seems. And so where does the money come from to do that? Do those savings from other categories kind of come back to you? You know, how does that work?
At this point in time, CICS is blessed with a fund balance. And so as we're building these services, we will be using that fund balance. It's the sustainability that, once we have these services, that is what legislators need to address. And that is part of the legislation that they're currently considering with additional crisis services, which would then become required for the regions to provide. And in there, they do have that it is the legislative intent to determine a sustainable funding.
Okay, we're talking about a new bill that passed the House 98-0, and then is in the Senate, I believe, right now. Before we get there, let's share that crisis hotline number. What is that crisis center hotline?
It's 844-258-8858.
844-258-8858.
Correct.
Okay. That's the mental health crisis hotline for our region, our 10-county region. Folks who call that will have a trained person speak with them, and then that person will determine whether a visit in person is called for, right?
Right, correct.
Starting at the end of this month.
Correct.
So the diversion savings that are created, for instance, when someone doesn't go to jail but instead gets referred to a service or a stabilization program, that savings doesn't really come back to you. It just comes back to the state at large or the county at large, right?
Correct. Particularly for if we're diverting individuals from expensive hospital stays, then that is a Medicaid savings. It still saves the system, but it does not come back to the regions.
Okay. So now you are talking among legislators about, hey, we need to reprioritize our funding as well as our systems of delivery. Talk about this new bill that was introduced, the complex needs bill.
Yes, that's what it's referred to.
Because it is so complex, mental health care. So what are the provisions there that make it so popular, 98-0?
Well, the first thing is that they are moving some of those crisis services that were considered additional into core services. So regions are required, if they have the funding available, to develop those services. Along with that, they identified additional ACT teams, so assertive community treatment teams, which we actually have that developing in CICS as well in the Story and Boone area. This is a team of professionals. There's a case manager that's part of that team, and then mental health professionals as well. So they work specifically on individuals' goals and develop a plan just around them.
And so you have this complex needs bill. It looks like it will pass given its huge popularity in the House. But there's still that funding mandate that needs to occur. There's it, you know, all of these changes at the moment are kind of, you need to do this asterisk if you have the money to do it, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there needs to be another step taken by the legislature if this is truly to become realized, and that would be to fund these programs.
Absolutely.
Okay. So folks who might be visiting with legislators at this time, you know, don't be satisfied with their support of the House or Senate version of this complex needs bill. You have to follow up and say, now, will you fund it, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you are an administrator. You're the CEO of this very big organization providing mental health services to folks in central Iowa. What has been your contact with mental illness, and what drives you in this work?
I think, you know, one in five people may experience a crisis, a mental health crisis in any given year. I don't think any of us are immune to that. We have family members, loved ones, and just acquaintances that we have had to deal with throughout the years. And so it does become personal. I think everybody on our administrative team has been touched in one way or another with mental health or developmental disabilities. So, you know, I think that's what drives us, wanting to make the system better, giving people answers that have been seeking for years.
Right.
It's just, it is a passion. Every one of the admin team feels very passionate about what we do. And we do, you know, we just want to make life better.
How have you seen a life made better by the services that are funded by your organization?
Well, even prior to regionalization, I became aware of the situation where an individual should have been able to reach out and get help, but they kept hearing that there wasn't any help for somebody in his situation with a co-occurring mental health and substance use disorder. The individual ended up in jail. Just right before that, I had been out to visit with the new sheriff and had talked to him about possibly having outpatient services in the jail. Well, this individual got hooked up with a provider while he was in the jail, and later on when he was released, he kept that contact with them, continued into treatment, continued to get mental health help and, you know, medication assistance. And he stopped by my office a week ago, and it has been 5 years that he has been sober, not been in trouble, has kept a job. And so just, you know, knowing that we can make a difference in people's lives, that's what keeps us going.
Wow. What a wonderful gesture of him to visit and report on his experience. And for those who think that there is no help out there, we should, again, reiterate that hotline number, which is staffed 24/7. It begins with some eights, right?
Yes. 844-258-8858.
Okay. And you did just mention a case that involved substance abuse, and that is a diagnosis in the DSM-5. It's a psychological disorder. Are there sufficient substance abuse treatment programs in the region?
There is not. And that's kind of a disconnect that's always been there. Iowa Department of Public Health funds substance use disorder, and then we've got, you know, DHS with mental health. So we're trying to bridge that gap and trying to figure out how to work together. The substance use disorder treatment has not been under the county mental health purview before, nor has it been under the region's. So we are really looking at how we can bridge that gap, because many individuals do have co-occurring disorders.
Right. It just makes it unnecessarily complicates things if you have two different agencies working
right.
on a single case. And it seems that law enforcement is often involved in those cases as well.
Right, correct. And they don't, law enforcement doesn't necessarily separate the two, and we shouldn't either.
I see. Okay. Any last comments about this? What is the role of someone who wants to get involved? Are those mental health first aid training classes, are those just open to anyone?
Yes, they are. We often have certain people who contact us to provide those. And, you know, and so at that point, we will then advertise and allow anyone to join that class if they would like.
Okay. So would that be like a church, or perhaps a school decides that their teachers should be trained in this?
We've had libraries contact us. I know we just got done training a business who really felt like that was important for them. Some counties have reached out and wanted every one of their staff members trained. So it's just a wide variety. So.
Interesting. Well, it's really exciting what you're doing. And we've talked about you were given a big pile of stuff to deal with when the changeover from county to regional administration occurred a few years ago. You've worked through a lot of the basics, it sounds like, and now you're really focusing on optimizing the services that you provide to folks in need.
Thank you. Yes.
And we've been talking to Jody Eaton. She is the CEO of CICS, the mental health region that provides care to 10 counties. For folks who are underinsured or uninsured for those services. Thank you so much, Jody.
Thank you.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI, and we're hearing about new mental health developments in the area.
I wanted to hear more about the mobile crisis response service, that game changer, as Jody called it, which is going to go live at the end of March. So I spoke with Christina Engler, the director of crisis services for Ierley Ball. That's I'm not sure whether it's nonprofit or for-profit, but it is in contract with the region for various services. They're already contracted, and now they've gotten this additional contract for a mobile crisis response service. So here's Christina Engler, and I'll just let the listeners know there will be one more chance to write down that hotline number in case they haven't gotten it. So get your writing implements ready. Here's Christina Engler.
Last fall, CICS put out a proposal, and Ierley Ball applied to that, and we were granted the opportunity to come up with this crisis response team. Our entire program is crisis services, but at this point, we're really focused on the crisis response part of it out in the community. So around the end of the month, we're hoping, will be our go-live date, in that we will be able to have three teams situated across these 10 counties go out and respond in situations where an in-person intervention may be necessary. So that could be someone who's experiencing depression, anxiety, suicidal ideations, homicidal ideations, hallucinations, psychosis, substance use or abuse, or any combination really of those items. And some just want somebody to talk to. And so in this case, they would be able to call into the CICS hotline, which is already live. So what's neat about this is anyone can access that hotline. So it could be first responders, community members, coworkers, friends, family, concerned others. And they can call this hotline number. CICS already has a contract where they are receiving over-the-phone counseling with this number, and then come the end of the month, we're hopeful that our service will also be available. So this team, they will then dispatch us out if they feel in-person intervention would be helpful. We will have three teams. Like, each team will have two members. Those two members have to meet certain state code guidelines. So they could be like a peer support, a bachelor's level individual with mental health experience, a nurse, a police officer, an EMT, a therapist, a social worker. It's a wide range, and all of these individuals will have 30 hours of training. Depending on where they land in those kind of criteria, they will have an additional 30 hours in order to make sure that we're comfortable with crisis intervention, de-escalation, coming up with safety plans for these clients. So after they are dispatched, those two individuals will meet near the call and present to the call together.
Now, when you say dispatched, are they driving their own vehicles to the scene and then meeting up?
You are correct, yep. So these individuals, a lot of them have full-time jobs, so they're picking up these hours as kind of supplemental work, or they're just really interested in this sort of work. So they'll be on call from the comfort of their own home, and then once they're dispatched, they will drive in their own vehicles and meet at this site.
Okay.
Yeah.
And would any medications ever be administered at that point to the person who is suffering from the mental health crisis?
No medications will actually be administered, but we will talk about kind of what medications they're currently taking. Do they see a provider? Do they see a therapist? Do they have support when it comes to psychiatric care? They'll do a behavioral health assessment, kind of the suicidal risk assessment, lethality of that, come up with all the social support, everything, and then that report will be entered into a system that we will all have access to as a team. The next day, within 24 hours, case managers will follow up on that call. So that's where then those case managers will be very well versed in resources, referrals in each of those 10 counties. And they will be the one who meets that individual, figures out what resources, referrals do we need to set up, what do we need to reestablish, or which ones aren't working for them, and kind of hone in on that and figure out what would be best for that client.
So there is it's kind of a wraparound mm-hmm. service. Now, does that dovetail with the things that you're already doing at Ireley Ball? Like the case managers, mm-hmm. are those people who are already working at Ireley Ball to help with
yeah.
clients who have mental health care needs?
Yep. There's several organizations who we'll kind of collaborate with. Our case managers, we don't want to be taking over services. So we're very short term, but we're wanting to connect with the correct services. So whether that's CICS and their care coordinators or other agencies within the 10 county span or Ireley Ball. So whoever that may be, we want to get that individual connected to the best services that'll suit their needs best.
Okay. Well, this hotline number sounds like a really important number that mm-hmm. everybody should have on their refrigerator.
Yes, they should.
So what is it?
That phone number is 1-844-258-8858. And that is 24/7, just like our service will also be 24/7.
844-258-8858. How about if we have you do it, Christina?
Yeah, of course. Okay, so the number that we want you guys to call is 844-258-8858.
And that is for any kind of mental health crisis that you see developing that you think requires intervention, either over the phone or possibly someone can come and help intervene. So if somebody calls, is there any financial consequence? Mm-hmm. Are they entering into some kind of financial relationship with you mm-hmm. if they call this service?
No, we do not actually bill the clients. We will bill Medicaid if the client does have Medicaid. CACS, the region, has recognized the need for this, and it is a very expensive service, but we're hoping that there will be cost savings in other departments, such as keeping people out of the hospital or even the ERs. Those can be very expensive visits and not always necessary. And so we want to minimize those costs, as well as keeping law enforcement and first responders on the streets and doing what they need to do. So ultimately, there will be cost savings in other areas, but the client themselves will not actually receive a bill.
Well, we're excited that the region has decided to invest
yes.
in this kind of program. It sounds like something that's would possibly save lives, but certainly save a lot of struggle.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Christina Engel.
Thank you.
And that was Christina Engel, who is a psychiatric nurse and is the director of crisis services at Ierley Ball. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Now, Christina told me that she was part of a similar team operating out of Polk County for Polk County's mobile crisis response team before that service got taken over by Broadlands. And there are several specifications of this program in our region that make it a real step up. So first of all, the Polk County mobile teams were not 24/7. They shut down at midnight or so. And so we all know that many emergencies don't happen within regular business hours. So in that case, again, sometimes the only place that was open was the emergency room. Second of all, the responder in that other program had to go into the situation solo. It seems much better, much safer to have two people involved in the response. And finally, the only people who could access that system, the mobile crisis response system in Polk County, was law enforcement.
So regular people who were having an emergency or seeing others involved in an emergency could not dial up the service?
No. And as you can imagine, that this makes a world of difference in terms of getting people connected to the resources they need. So that's why Christina is so very enthusiastic about this program in our region.
Maybe in 3 or 4 years, Iowa will no longer be the number 50 among states in its provision of mental health care.
We can certainly hope that's the case. And it seems like we're headed in the right direction, provided, of course, that this issue and crisis services get the funding it needs at the state level. A couple of additional notes. Some of our listeners may have already heard that Mary Greeley Hospital has decided to create a crisis stabilization and transitional center right here in Ames to provide intensive support for mental health patients. Previously, folks would have to go as far as Woodward, Iowa, and the Hope Wellness Center there to get that kind of longer-term inpatient service. That center is planned to open in August, and we'll be interviewing Vice President and Chief of Nursing Neil Lowes about that in the coming weeks. And I will be attending one of those mental health first aid sessions this coming Saturday in Nevada, and I'm going to report on that next week.
Thanks, Greta, for bringing us this really valuable information.
And we'll have links to all of those resources on the webpage, khoifm.org.
And you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was a song sung by Sinead O'Connor, singing in the Irish language, also known as Gaelic. And I'm not going to try to pronounce the title of that song because it is in Gaelic. But it was about Ireland's iconic heroine, Grace O'Malley, who fought against the oppression of the Irish people by Britain. This is Local Talk on KHOI, and we've been joined in the studio by folks who are going to tell us about the upcoming poverty simulation in which people can participate, and we'll hear what people will get out of it and learn from it. So with us now, we have Brian Pates, Mason Adams, and we also have Breanne Sullivan with us. Can one of you tell us, what is a poverty simulation?
A poverty simulation is an opportunity for individuals in the community to kind of get to experience in 15-minute increments, about a month in the life of what it's like to be, you know, poverty level or low income. It's a program that I believe was developed by University of Missouri, licensed materials, and just gives you different scenarios and situations for different family structures, some of the kind of inherent struggles and situations they might find themselves in, and releases them kind of into the wild on trying to survive and make it through a week with very limited money, access to different resources, bills to pay. You may or may not have a job, and kids, you know, children in different sorts of situations. And so it's an hour's worth of a lot of anxiety and stress, the likes of which most of us have not experienced in our lifetime. So
you actually kind of take on someone else's identity and try to,
correct,
and then you're hit with certain realities of their life in a short period of time. An hour, you said?
Yeah. Start to finish, it's roughly an hour, and you kind of work through 15-minute weekly increments, and then you kind of gather back together once the time is up for that week.
So it's an hour of the actual kind of, I'm going to call it role playing, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah.
And then time to talk about it and process. And
yeah, you kind of go through. You have different family things that you have, and you're given different opportunities and different struggles to go through, where you need to go and get, say, rental assistance, or you need to be able to go to the grocery store to get food for your family, different things like that.
And we'll say it again later, but tell people when and where this will be.
So this will be on March 29th at the Farewell T. Brown Auditorium at the Ames Public Library from 9:30 to 12.
And anyone can attend?
Right.
Okay. Do they need to sign up in advance?
Yes. We have registration going on now, and they would need to reach out to Breanne Sullivan directly. Got her contact information on here, 515-268-5142, or they can visit the community events page on the Ames Chamber of Commerce website, and that has all of her contact information there.
And we'll put that information on our website when we post the show. So what would you say people who participate in this will learn? What will they get out of it?
Just speaking on behalf of my own experience in participating, so we got an opportunity to participate in this event last October with the Leadership Ames class out at Cornerstone Church. And one of the main things that I took away from it was just that sense of anxiety on how to make ends meet, and realizing there are just some major barriers to families, individuals, to be able to get ahead, to take that next step. And some of those barriers that I've not encountered in my life, just, you know, with kind of the luck of the draw and, you know, being, you know, born into a upper middle class family in the area. So that was one of my big takeaways, was not just saying, hey, you can do it, we can all do it, we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, and mm-hmm. we can all get ahead if you just work harder. Well, in some of these situations, no matter how hard they work, just the opportunity to get ahead and make that next step is just, it's almost insurmountable.
Some barriers are related to people's identities, like their race or ethnicity. Are those topics that come up in the simulation?
All of the volunteers will be assigned a specific family role. So when the poverty simulation was designed, a lot of those factors were thought of. So there's some built-in barriers already in the simulation. And then I know we wanted to dedicate a pretty large portion of the morning to talking about discussion of what those barriers kind of are in our community. Mm. So we definitely are anticipating that a lot of those topics will come up as well. And we'll talk about not only awareness, but what steps can be taken to try to break down some of these barriers.
People in the area might think, oh, we live in Ames, we live in Story County, there's not much poverty here, this isn't really needed. So can you speak to that?
Sure. I think that poverty looks different in all areas. And when you see poverty represented on television or in the news, it might not be what it looks like here in Story County. United Ways of Iowa did a study a couple years ago studying the ALICE population, which means asset limited, income constrained, and employed. So it's basically the working poor. Mm-hmm. It's a group of people that fall above the federal poverty line but still aren't making ends meet. So we're going to present a little bit about that at the financial stability event on the 29th, and we're hoping that will spur a lot of conversation about what poverty looks like here locally.
Is the idea that action will come from this or more awareness?
So I think we wanted to kind of spark a conversation between the powers to be, such as those with housing connections and aims, and those with the ability to hire those in like HR capacities, to kind of make the connection there and kind of show that there are people in the community that need this kind of assistance, and kind of maybe bring a revelation that there are the people here.
And so people might then be compelled to figure out what they could do or their organization could do differently to help people meet some of these obstacles.
Right. Yeah, I think Brian hit it on the head there is getting a lot of the right people in one room at one time experiencing, you know, that hour-long simulation, but then giving them the opportunity to, you know, take a breath and then discuss in an open forum with individuals, you know, key decision makers and stakeholders in the community that can really enact some change. That was a key for us, was getting the right people in the room. And I'm sure we probably won't have enough on that day. So that's kind of what we're doing here today is trying to get more people in that room over at the library to bring their ideas, bring their thoughts, feelings, opinions, and get enough conversation going to, you know, start some action.
And have you then invited or targeted specific groups that you think would be beneficial for them to participate?
When we began kind of recruiting for the simulation, we were really targeting housing providers and property managers and HR for large employers in the area. But as we kind of got a little closer to the simulation, we realized that every community resident really does have ties to this ALICE population, and we do all have a role to play in the change and breaking down some barriers to financial stability as well. So we opened it up to everyone. We're hoping that anyone who's interested can come and learn and help us kind of figure out what those action steps need to be.
And this is being put on by a collaboration between different community groups. Is that correct?
Our group, Forever 31, is a subset of Leadership Ames, class of 31. So Brian and I are both members of that group in Leadership Ames. There are a few other members who weren't able to make it here today.
And is that associated with the Chamber of Commerce?
Yes, okay. That is correct. Yeah, Leadership Ames is put on by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Uh-huh. So they've kind of led the charge and put out a message to local nonprofits to help solicit potential projects for Leadership Ames groups to work on and undertake. And this was one that we had identified as our number one.
And then AmeriCorps Vista got involved?
Yeah. So I'm in AmeriCorps Vista at the United Way of Story County. So this year I am working on understanding different barriers to financial stability in our community. And I volunteered at the Leadership Ames Poverty Simulation back in October that Brian and Mason had participated in, and kind of thinking about what I was working at United Way of Story County to do and to understand. And I thought it would be a really great idea to kind of bring this opportunity to participate in the simulation and an opportunity to discuss barriers in our community. And so that's when I came up with the idea to put on a poverty simulation. The idea has kind of evolved since working with the Leadership Ames team. And now we have created the financial stability event.
So it's really a coming together of minds to figure out how to approach it. Is this the first time something like this has been done in this area?
So we did it as an event for one of the days for Leadership Ames. I believe it was on the nonprofit day. So everybody that went through the Leadership Ames class went through the poverty simulation. I think that's what really spoke to our group as we went through the project selection process for Leadership Ames was we went through the poverty simulation, and it really showed what people that have daily struggles and barriers to financial stability go through on a daily basis. And I think that's what it really spoke out to us and had us select and try to select this project and then kind of bring it forward to the public again.
So this is the first time it's really being done and open to anyone who wants to attend.
Yeah.
And have you gotten pretty good sign up so far? People probably wait till the last minute.
Yes, we have marked our deadline to registration as March 26th.
Okay.
We've had a lot of interest from groups we didn't necessarily anticipate interest from, and that's what really drove us from opening it up from just targeting housing providers and large area employers to everyone, because we thought if someone's really interested in participating, they definitely have something to say, a reason to be there. So.
And maybe you could explain what Leadership Ames is. We've mentioned that a few times, but what is that?
So Leadership Ames is put on by the Ames Chamber. It's a leadership series. I believe it's 12 sessions over 9 months where you go through various days, nonprofit day. I'm trying to think of some other ones.
Industrial, ag,
education.
Government.
Yep. And then you kind of build. There's a couple of days in there where there's a leadership development skills as well. And then everybody gets put into a group as well, and they do a project to benefit or further the community.
And AmeriCorps Vista is a one-year commitment that you're on?
Yeah. So AmeriCorps Vista is a national program, and right, different nonprofits can submit applications. It helps them increase their capacity. So I will be at United Way for 1 year, and after I leave, another Vista will step in and continue working on the project.
So is the idea that you hope this goes well and then it will carry on after this year?
We definitely hope it goes well.
Yes.
So if people are listening and maybe thinking, I might want to do this, but I don't know, a morning is a big commitment. What would you say to tell them to maybe make the plunge and get involved?
I would say it left an impression on me. I think that it's something that you'll definitely get benefit from going to. It really shows, again, the daily struggle or daily barriers that people have just to make ends meet or even put food on the table. So,
tell us once again when and where.
So it's March 29th at the Farewell T. Brown Auditorium at the Ames Public Library from 9:30 a.m. to noon. It involves United Way partner agencies, area businesses such as Sigler, American Packaging, First Property Management, Haverkamp Properties, Starbucks, and the Ames Eye Clinic.
Anything else people should know?
Yeah, just again, want to thank our corporate sponsors, as Brian mentioned there, Andrea Hammes Dodge at the Ames Chamber of Commerce, our Leadership Ames co-chairs who were in the Leadership Ames class last year, Kelsey Bolte Carper and Adam Bates. And obviously the Ames Public Library for allowing us to have the event space to host the event for the day. So
thank you very much for coming in and telling us about it. I've been speaking with Brian Pates, Mason Adams, and Breanne Sullivan about the poverty simulation. Thanks again.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Thanks to Greta Anderson for coming in with her interviews on mental health care in the area, and to our guests on the poverty simulation. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. The snow is melting and things are warming up, so it is a good time to open up your wallet or checkbook and become a member of KHOI. You can go to our website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button or call 515-292-2878. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.